We knew that every day that a vehicle broke down, we would have to destroy it. And these are maybe $80,000 vehicles, maybe $100,000. You know, they're expensive trucks. We're burning fuel in front of Iraqi people. We're not really doing anything to help, and we just have to follow the orders.
As a truck driver in the mail department, they'd send me to these camps with one bag of mail. That's risking my life just to deliver one bag of mail.
Escort entire convoys where every flatbed truck was empty.
The allegations come from 12 truckers complaining that the company was wasting government money by running empty trucks on the convoys and billing the government for them.
And it seems senseless to travel up and down the road and taking a chance of losing your life when there wasn't no purpose in it. When you went up empty and you come back empty.
The allegation.
I went to make a better life for my family. Always have a roof over their head and not have to worry about where their next meal's coming from.
It wasn't that fun with him gone. We missed him and all that stuff.
I couldn't do stuff with him.
Didn't have anybody to throw a baseball with, did you? I'd go take you fishing. Your mom was scared you'd fall in and get drowned, wouldn't she?
Yeah.
I went over there and I got my health messed up and got shot, bricked, knocked out, and everything else. I felt like not only I can make a decent living for my family and better myself, but I'd be doing something for my country. You know what I'm saying? I'm supplying the military and these guys where they can eat and help fight when we have to. But then, you know, you're looking and you're going up and down the road empty. Halliburton's charging the government for every camp they go by, and your buddy's getting killed for no cause at all, not even as much as a Band-Aid on the truck. That's how Halliburton was making their killing, making their money, is a legal way of stealing from the American citizen and the military.
Halliburton is accused of hundreds of millions of dollars in improper charges.
Pentagon auditors have found potential overcharges of $61 million.
Now the numbers are apparently even larger than previously thought.
Halliburton's unreasonable and unsupported bills exceed $1 billion.
If anybody's overcharging the government, we expect them to repay that money.
It's been proven so many times that Halliburton has overbilled them. And then the Pentagon still pays them anyway. I don't know who it is that is protecting Halliburton. I don't understand why the military would protect them.
If you look at their board of directors, they've got contacts in the State Department, contacts in the military.
Jim Donahue, Halliburton Watch.
People who work for Halliburton once worked for the military.
When you hire top Pentagon officials, when the vice president is your former CEO, you're going to get the access that other people don't.
It is reportedly not a coincidence that Vice President Dick Cheney's old company got a huge contract to help rebuild Iraq. Time magazine said it has gotten a hold of a Pentagon email saying Cheney's office coordinated Halliburton's multi-billion dollar deal.
Charles Lewis, Fund for Independence in Journalism.
All the revelations came out about Halliburton getting all these fancy no-bid contracts. There was not a single hearing in the Congress, House or Senate, about the mysterious bidding processes around Iraq and Halliburton. That's ridiculous.
The oversight responsibility belongs to the United States Congress. It belongs here, and it's not happening here.
The Senate should spend a little less time advertising allegations of wrongdoing and spend more time talking about what is going right.
If anybody believes that the contracts handed to Halliburton for Iraq weren't, you know, the moral equivalent of insider trading, man, I've got an ocean in the middle of Kansas I'd like to take you surfing on. It's just phenomenal. I mean, of course they were insider deals. Of course it was payback for old friends and political supporters and campaign contributors.
Massey Rich, Center for Responsive Politics.
They're very strategic in how they allocate their political contributions. You'll see most of their money going to the committees that oversee military matters and funding for it.
Halliburton campaign contribution, $4.386 million.
When you pay influence money, in the form of campaign contributions, it means people look the other way.
The U.S. Army announced today it signed a new contract with a unit of the huge contracting firm Halliburton.
The military fights for the guy next to you or the guy in the next foxhole who you've trained with, slept with, ate with, spent all your time living with and working with.
Chris Farrell, Judicial Watch.
From the corporate side, it's a question of where's the next contract coming from?
Halliburton's stock has quadrupled in value since the war began, and taxpayers are being ripped off.
Keith Ashton.
The people in charge say we want to give to contractors because they can do it cheaper. Well, lo and behold, the evidence is now coming in, and it isn't cheaper, and we're not actually getting what we're paying for.
David Lazar, CEO, Halliburton. Income from Halliburton in 2004, $42,637,920.
We were writing contracts with Halliburton and others to do things that Iraqis could have done better and far, far cheaper. And by the way, we would have gotten Iraqis off the street and given them the jobs.
Let us stop the war profiteers.
Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat, Vermont.
Let us say no to them, and let us say, if you continue to, you're going to go to jail because that's where you belong. My amendment would stop them.
There hasn't been a single major piece of contracting oversight legislation passed by the Congress since the war began.
Charlie Cray, Center for Corporate Policy.
Not even a significant amendment has been passed, despite all the enormous amounts of fraud and waste and abuse.
There needs to be a special committee established, a bipartisan committee, to take a look at waste and fraud and abuse.
The amendment is not agreed to.
The amendment is not adopted.
And the Leahy Amendment is not agreed to.
If I had the heads of Khaki, of Titan, of KBR, let's say, what would Thomas Jefferson have to say if he saw the level of profit that had been included in war fighting? What would Benjamin Franklin say?
The government of the people, by the people, and for the people is really of, by, and for the companies that are getting the contracts. And that is not the American people.
Raytheon, Parsons, and DHB are not America as I know it. Their greed goes against our grain.
We have more and more money that are going out to these companies and less people watching the federal piggy bank.
We need greater oversight in this war, even more than in past wars, because this war has been privatized to a greater extent than any other war in history.
I voted for some of these people, okay? Let's see what happens. Let's see if anybody gets in trouble for this. Let's see how many people go to prison. Let's see who loses the contract over this.
I know we have a battle ahead from Lockheed Martin to Dynacorp and Bechtel. The profiteers are not going to easily transform into patriots.
The people have the money, the people who are making a profit have a lot of power and a lot of money and a lot of influence. And so I think it will really take something big, a big movement here in the United States.
You know, I love my country. I'd stand behind it. I'm concerned now in a way probably that I've never been concerned before because I don't like what I'm seeing. America's become a powder keg, I think, and it's just waiting for match.
This Iraqi movement, how are you going to win the hearts and minds of these people if they see you cheating your own people, if all this stuff is just for the money? Before we can point the finger at anybody else, we need to get the cinder out of our own eye, and we need to clean house a little bit.
I think the world really needs to know what's going on over there. There has to be accountability, and we need to stop it.
I am a patriot. I love our country, and I want our country to survive. and the survival of our country depends on us taking it back.
Tony Fredrickson's office.
I was wondering if I could request an interview with Eric Prince.
Recording. Hi, Kathy Mann. It's Robert Greenwald and Amanda Spain calling from Los Angeles. We're working on the film Iraq for Sale.
We want to get Mr. Fredrickson's perspective.
We're really very anxious to have Halliburton and Mr. Lazar in the film. Yes, Robert Greenwald and Abby Hurwitz here. We've discovered, frankly, quite a bit of very troubling material. I thought letting people know that we found something critical would be fairer than just kind of trying to sucker punch them about Halliburton KBR's role in the war and the war profiteering.
We'll put the whole transcript from the interview up on our website.
Hi, Angela. How are you? This is Abby Hurwitz. I left a message with Lindsay Taylor last Friday requesting an interview with Eric Prince, and I was wondering tomorrow.
We really want to give you an opportunity to be heard. I know that it's been quite a bit of time and you have not responded.
I was wondering if there was anyone in your organization that would like to be interviewed to represent your company.
Can I get your email address? Okay.
Can you please put me through to her? Oh, I thought she was going to be in all day. Remember, early morning, late tonight?
This is my third call to Titan.
This is Robert Greenwald and Amanda Spain calling from Los Angeles. I think we talked to you yesterday.
Permission to make a documentary?
Yes, Jody Brown. It's Robert Greenwald and Amanda Spain calling again. It's Wednesday, July 26th. We've emailed five or six times.
And that's to get an interview with Mr. Fredrickson?
I put in a request to have an interview with Eric Prince.
We're just about at our deadline here.
The reason why I keep calling is because we're kind of under some time constraints.
I guess Kathy Mann's unavailable till Thursday, and someone's going to try to reach Melissa Norcross.
Eric Prince. He's not available.
Hello, Mr. Prince. This is Robert Greenwald and Abby Hurwitz.
I've emailed her like five or six times.
The month of calling and emailing and talking has gotten us nothing. Jody Brown, it's Robert Greenwald and Amanda Spain calling again.
Our film is going to wrap soon.
We could interview Mr. Lazar tomorrow, Wednesday, Thursday, possibly even Friday. We still have time to interview Mr. London. We could do it in the next couple of days.
Oh, okay. I got you.
Is that just a way of saying you don't want to have anything to do with it? Because saying you can't at this time over a period of a month just leads us to believe either you don't want to do it or there's something you don't want to say. We don't know what it is.
Would you do me a favor for my boss? Will you just write that to me?
Will a day make a difference? Will a week, a month, a year, 5 years?
Okay, so y'all are saying no.
So you are definitely going to turn it down?
No. No.
No. You've been listening to a radio adaptation of Iraq for Sale, a film produced and directed by Robert Greenwald. Greenwald has made a number of political documentaries, including Outfoxed and Walmart, The High Cost of Low Price. He has founded Brave New Films, which instead of focusing on the usual industry distribution channels and the profit motive, is providing low-cost DVDs which people can buy to hold free screenings in the community. Greenwald hopes to eventually be able to give his DVDs away in order to serve the public interest and subvert the corporate control of information. You can learn more about this work and how to see the films at bravenewfilms.org. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, 88.1 Ithaca Community Radio, Free Radio Santa Cruz, KRFP Moscow, Free Radio Olympia, KQRP Salida, WGDR Plainfield, Free Radio Asheville, WZKW Kingsville, KOWA Olympia, WRFN Nashville, KWMD Kosilov Anchorage, KRBS Oroville, The Surge 96.3, Radio Veronica US, WYQZ Warrenton Bealeton, or WMRW Warren.
I joined the Army when high school was through. I didn't know what else to do. Thought I'd take care of that traveling Jones and maybe take out some student loans. They sent me away to the land of the dead. I didn't know a word they said. I got shot at a lot. I was nearly toast, but it's the ones I killed that hurts the most. Most of the time I didn't know what was going on. The rest of the time I knew there was something going wrong. Every reason we were there turned out to be a lie. I thought of that each time I saw another person die. I was supposed to stay a year, but it kept me for four. By the time I got back home, no one knew me anymore. Of the man I once was, there didn't seem to be a trace. And when I looked me in the mirror, I didn't recognize my face. I wasn't home too long before the time that I fell ill. It was like the air was thick as mud and I ached enough to kill. I didn't know I'd been fighting in a nuclear war. DU was in my blood and I was knocking on death's door. I can't tell you how it felt to be betrayed at every turn. Like the earth was spinning backwards, like my heart began to burn, like I had to do something while I still had the strength to stand, while I still could run with a machine gun in my hand. And I thought of Halliburton and the military brass and the things they get away with all for their ruling class. But I'm not a pawn and I can't just let it be. And if I'm gonna die, I'm gonna take some of them fuckers with me. I'll spare you the details. I did what I had to do. There's a boardroom blown to hell, and soon I will be too. You can say I lost it, you can say that I'm insane, but may no one ever say that my death was in vain. I joined the Army when high school was through. I didn't know what else to do.
That was Halliburton Boardroom Massacre by David Rovics, the title track for his new CD. Check him out at davidrovics.com. We'll dig deeper into the mafia-like nature of the Bush administration and their associates with Washington insider turned author and investigative journalist Wayne Madsen. Madsen has covered Washington, D.C., politics, national security, and intelligence issues since 1994. He's a former U.S. naval officer who was assigned to the National Security Agency during the Reagan administration. He also has some 20 years' experience in computer security and data privacy. His most recent book is Jaded Tasks, Brass Plates, Black Ops, and Big Oil, The Blood Politics of George Bush and Company. He spoke November 1st in Portland, Oregon.
I want to thank the United States Army for helping me come up with the name of the book. I had the book written, but I didn't really have a working title for it. Then all of a sudden, in 2004, the United States, for the second time, overthrew the democratically elected president of Haiti, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, in a military coup. And that coup was basically formulated and planned as a covert operation by U.S. Special Forces in the neighboring Dominican Republic. And the name of the covert operation was called Operation Jaded Task. I said, it's perfect. They're all jaded tasks. That's how I came up with the title. Now, you know, the thing is about when they assign a covert term to an operation, a covert term to a covert operation, The rules are it can't have anything to do with the actual operation. It's a masking term. It's to camouflage what it really is. So I said either somebody made a terrible mistake by calling it Operation Jaded Task, or somebody in the U.S. Army has a great sense of humor. But anyway, jaded is defined in the dictionary as cynically or pretentiously callous. And that's a great term for the Bush administration, the Bush family, and all of their cohorts and colleagues in crime. What I tried to do in the book was bring together a lot of different events that have taken place where the Bush administration has just really pushed the envelope. And I came up with this term. You know, every week would go by, there would be another scandal, either involving Bush or Rumsfeld or Jerry Bremer with the Coalition Provisional Authority, or these criminals in Congress, Duke Cunningham, Bob Ney. And, you know, every week we were just inundated with another scandal. And I talked to my colleagues in Washington, my friends, and people that I bounce things off of, and they would just shake their head. And, you know, another scandal. They say, oh, another scandal, another day. So I came up with this new syndrome, and I call it moral indignation fatigue. And I really think the country, and in fact the world, suffers from this because of this administration. Moral indignation fatigue. What are you going to tell me that's going to top the scandal from last week? Well, I thought there wasn't anything until just a few weeks ago with the Mark Foley situation. And I can tell you that it was no accident that that scandal came out earlier this month. Now, the Republicans will have you believe that the Democrats had this information and sat on it. Au contraire. As a matter of fact, a Democratic member of the House Page Board, Dale Kildee from Michigan, said he never even heard of any of this. And he's probably the longest-serving member of that House Page Board that there is. He's been on there well over 10 years. He said he never heard of any of this, even though we now know that Foley had problems as early as 1995 when he first came to the House from Florida, that Jim Colby from Arizona was implicated, that Hastert was involved in the cover-up. The fact is, why it came out in early October is thanks to some career FBI agents and career Justice Department attorneys who knew, who had been hearing about these incidents, were told about these incidents by members of the staff in the House of Representatives, and we're told we're not going to pursue this by two attorneys general, Ashcroft and Alberto Gonzalez. And finally, they had enough. Now, did they time it? Sure they did. Because there are people in the Justice Department, the FBI, that want to see the Bush people go as much as anybody else. So these are the career people. These are not the political appointees. And this gets into where I get my sources for the book and also for the website. There are people, rest assured, in our government, in the Central Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, the FBI, and a whole host of those other alphabet soup agencies that do not like what they're saying and will talk off the record. And they talk anonymously, and I have to sometimes go to great lengths to make sure that they're not identified. When I talk to them about what goes on inside their agencies, I do not talk to them over the telephone for obvious reasons, especially if the person I'm talking to works at the National Security Agency. nor do I email them for the same reasons. The most secure means of communication is face-to-face with precautions. And I have met sources in softball fields where the chain... We meet in the backstop area where the chain link fence is, because that if somebody has a shotgun microphone, that attenuates a signal. They can't pick it up because of the fencing. Because the people I'm talking to are professionals that know what they do on the other side. I've met people in the middle of woods, out in the middle of nowhere. I've met people in empty bars where the bar owner is a relative, and they keep the place closed, or they open up early and keep it closed so nobody else is in there while we meet. And you know, it seems like it's something out of that movie enemy of the state. But this really happens. And it's amazing. But what's really amazing is these people who come forward, they have everything to risk. Everything is on the table. These are not people who have worked for these agencies for 2 or 3 years. These are 17, 18, 19, and 20-year employees of these various agencies in the government. And they put a lot on the table. They risk a lot to come forward. We know some of them have already been identified. People like Sibel Edmonds, the FBI translator, certainly, and she's put together a group called the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition, which is now, I think, over 100 members who were all out of national security agencies, FBI, CIA, NSA, Defense Intelligence Agency, who have come forward with information, especially post 9/11. But the other thing I try to do in this book is, because the Bush family is so well connected and have been for a number of years. I mean, this is the George W. is the third generation. Prescott was his grandfather, the senator from Connecticut, who, of course, had an interesting business during World War II, trading with Nazi Germany after the attack on Pearl Harbor. Prescott, of course, laid the groundwork for George H.W. We know all about his background, but I really wanted to concentrate on this generation of Bushes more than the first two. And I took a look at some of the brothers you really don't know much about, especially the brother, the youngest of the brood, Marvin. Marvin's an interesting character. He lives in Northern Virginia, and right outside of Alexandria. Marvin is the least known, but there's probably a good reason for it. He's really the most corrupt of the corrupt. Marvin, for example, was on the board of directors of a company called Securicom, later changed its name to Stratasec. This was a security company that had a significant investment from the Saudis and the Kuwaitis prior to 9/11. The chairman of the company was Wirt Walker. Okay, that's Walker. You know, Walker Point. They got a geographical peninsula named after the Walkers up in Maine. That's in Kennebunkport. That's where the Bush compound is. It sits on Walker Point. Wirt Walker III is a cousin. He was a chairman of Securicom. It's interesting that on 9/11. Securicom had the contract for security at Dulles Airport, so the American Airlines Flight 77 hijackers penetrated the security to get on the flight. They also had the contract for security for the World Trade Center. Time in and time out, you look at the Bush family and their connections to the people who were not just tangentially involved in 9/11, but were absolutely connected to 9/11, and you find Bushes everywhere. Bushes are Walkers. And it's not coincidence. If we had an FBI that actually went after real criminals, this would be on the top of their list for criminal conspiracy. This would be a RICO case like no other RICO case ever. We saw Securicom Stratasec go out of business in 2003. It turns out that the two financial backers, Hector and Eduardo Orlansky in Florida, were tied up with the mob. No surprise, Bushes have been tied up with the mob for a number of years. But the company went out of business. And just about a week and a half later, after that happened, on September 29th, Marvin's, I guess you call her a maid or a domestic governess, he has two adopted kids, she kind of took care of these kids and did a lot of things around the Bush compound, Marvin Bush compound in Alexandria. Her name, Bertha Champagne, a longtime employee of Marvin Bush. She's at home this one evening. It's about 20 minutes to 9. Marvin comes home from whatever he was doing, that day, which I hate to think what he does on a daily basis. It's obviously it's illegal. He comes home, and she says, "Mr. Bush, would you like to see a videotape I have of myself and President Bush?" And he said, "Yeah, I'd like to see it." She said, "Well, it's out in my car. I'll have to go get it." Her car's parked in a driveway, a circular driveway in front of the house. And somehow after she opened the door to retrieve the tape, this vehicle, this SUV that she's driving, goes into gear all by itself, accelerates the gas pedal, and pins her up against this, what they call an outbuilding. It was the old Secret Service outbuilding from when George H.W. Bush was president. The son had Secret Service protection. Pinned poor Bertha up against this outbuilding, crushed her, killed her, and then the vehicle kept moving across the major street with a lot of traffic, a lot of D.C. traffic around 9 o'clock in the evening, and wound up in some bushes across the street. The Washington Post reported that under the fold, somewhere in the back of the paper. Marvin Bush dies in tragic accident. I called the Fairfax County Police. I said, "I'd like to see the police report." They said, "I'm sorry, that's classified." I said, "Since when are police reports classified?" They said, "Since now." I got the police report. So what I'm telling you about the videotape of this person, Bertha Champagne, comes right out of the police report, that report that no one was supposed to see. And now I can understand why. I don't know what happened to the videotape. I've been trying to find out if the police took that videotape or made a copy of it. But it's quite clear that just like with all other cases where the Bush family is involved, that, you know, pretty high-level people came down on the Fairfax County Police and told them to cover this thing up. There was no obituary notice in the paper. There was no announcement of a service. And a person who, one of my colleagues who helped me investigate this story, went and spoke to Mrs. Champagne's daughter, who changed the story even from what was in the police report and what Marvin told the police. She said, "Oh, no, my mother didn't die in the Bush residence. She died in the country club, the golf club across the street." So this is the way this family operates. Should we be surprised that a family that operates like that about one 63-year-old lady, a long-term employee of one of the Bush brothers, they lie about her death, that they also lie about the reasons to go to war in Iraq, that they lie about what brought about the 9/11 attacks? The family, it's a criminal syndicate. It's more than just a family. The Borgias were a family in Italy. This is a criminal syndicate. Because it's not just the Bushes, of course, when we throw in Jim Baker, the consigliere for the Bush family. We throw in these other people that have hung on to the Bushes for a number of years. We see this as really a criminal syndicate. We can go on with the other family members. That's Marvin, the one you never hear about, good old Marvin. Then there's Neil. We've heard a little more about Neil. Because Neil was a guy who stole all that money from Silverado Savings and Loan back during the second biggest heist in our nation's history, the largest being the Enron scandal, the second being the SNL heist. Neil Bush has a education software company called Ignite, with an exclamation point at the end of that. His biggest clients, no surprise, the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates. Neil went over to the United Arab Emirates, his friends in Dubai, right after 9/11. Told them what a great job they were doing. I don't know what he meant by that. But we now know, because of revelations from Richard Clark's book and other sources, that the reason the two attempted attacks on bin Laden in Afghanistan failed, the one in December of 98 and one in May of 99, cruise missile attacks to try to wipe out bin Laden and his al-Qaeda units, they were postponed, called off because, and it was called Operation Delenda, they were called off because there were United Arab Emirates, Dubai, royal family members hunting at a lodge in Afghanistan very close to where the Osama bin Laden was located. And they didn't want to kill them because that would have created an incident. So they postponed these two attacks. We find out that the Crown Prince of Dubai, who was on those hunting trips, is one of the best friends of Neil Bush and is a big investor in his companies. We also know that Neil had a company called Interlink Management Corporation. What was their specialty? Bio-war defense, specifically things like countering anthrax attacks. And just when you think you've heard the last moral indignation, just a couple weeks ago, another member of the Bush clan, the former chief judge for the second U.S. court in Connecticut, court circuit, John M. Walker. This is the Walkers, the Bush Walker people. He was appointed by Ronald Reagan in 85. He's a cousin of George H.W. Bush and George W. Bush. He was driving his car and he hit with his car a policeman who was directing traffic this one evening, killing him. Left four kids and a wife. And Judge Walker was not given a blood test or a breathalyzer. They said it wasn't necessary. So what I'm suggesting is one of the problems we have with this current administration is they think they are a monarchy. I'm reminded of a friend of mine when I used to work in the intelligence community myself, many as I say, a galaxy far, far away, a long, long time ago. He was installing a surveillance system for the Shah of Iran's government. And it was right before the Shah fell. He was at this on this island off in the Persian Gulf. And the Savak guy showed up to take him to the site. And he's driving his Mercedes down the road real fast, probably going about 90 miles an hour, and all of a sudden hits this poor peasant who's, you know, got his donkey cart and his donkey in the road. He sees the peasant fly into the field, and he says, "My God, aren't you going to stop and see what's wrong?" And he says, "No, he's only a peasant." But there's many other cases of suspicious deaths. I go into Cliff Baxter, the Enron official who was supposed to testify, supposedly committed suicide. See, the corporate media wants you to believe when they tell you it was a suicide, that's it. It's a suicide. End of story. I talk about Dr. Gus Weiss, former CIA official, and I talk about John Kuchel, the head of the Iraqi analysis desk at the State Department, who was apparently saying there's no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. And both these individuals, within weeks of each other, they both came out against the war. Weiss, very interesting. He used to work with Richard Pearl in Henry Scoop Jackson's office. You would have thought he was a neocon. He used to be pretty hard on the Soviet Union. He came out against the Iraq War. Both these individuals, within a couple weeks of each other, they said, media said, they dove off buildings in Washington, D.C., Kuchel from the roof of the State Department, which is secured. You cannot get to the roof of the State Department. And Dr. Weiss from the roof of the Watergate. Yeah, I've spoken at a couple of 9/11 anniversary functions, seminars. I spoke at the second anniversary at Riverside Church in New York. And 2 years after 9/11, I was pretty agnostic about this government involvement. I had suspicions, believe me. And any time, you know, I knew about the Carlisle meeting in Washington the morning of 9/11, where the brother of Bin Laden was there, George H.W. Bush was there, Frank Carlucci was there, all these people I had been tracking for a number of years. Carlucci. I didn't go into it because you can read it, but you know, my suspicions about some of these players began when I went to Rwanda in 1998 to find out who shot the plane down carrying two African presidents that triggered the worst genocide we've seen since World War II. But So I was still pretty agnostic. I knew a lot of things. I heard a lot of things. And from the second anniversary to the fifth anniversary, I came to the conclusion, and of course speaking to many people since the second anniversary, that 9/11 was a highly compartmentalized covert operation carried out to bring about a fascist dictatorship in this country. I see it very similar to the Reichstag fire. I see the same goals being implemented. And the Reichstag fire was blamed on the communists when, in fact, the Nazis did it. Hitler put through the Enabling Act, which tore up the Weimar Constitution. Basically, the Patriot Act and the Enabling Act are the same kinds of acts. They tore up, basically, constitutional rights that were afforded by both legal instruments. And that's the way I see it, because I think the evidence is overwhelming. And when you get even members of the 9/11 Commission saying, we feel we were lied to and we weren't given all the evidence, I mean, I don't need any more evidence than just their comments alone. We had the situation with the 9/11 Commission, and I asked Governor Kaine about this at a news conference. I said, Governor Kaine, what about some of the issues that have been put off the table by, like, the FBI on the stock put transactions on United Airlines and American Airlines and Travelers Insurance before 9/11, people made a lot of money. I said, the FBI says it's off the table. He says, well, I think it's still on the table. And then Lee Hamilton, his co-chairman, said, I reject the premise of your question. Well, it wasn't a question. It's fact that these transactions were made. Kaine was also asked about Minders being present when his investigators, which were all run by Phil Zelikow, who's, you know, he's a Condoleezza Rice person, right? He was asked about Minders being present when they went to the CIA and FBI and NSA people and asked them these questions. And he said he didn't like the Minders. He didn't like them there. And he said, are they still there? It's halfway through their commission. They had 6 months left before the report. And he said, yeah, we still have the Minders, and I still don't like them. So after I saw the thing when Hamilton corrected him about the stock puts, I caught him after the news conference. I said, Governor Kaine, I said, is Lee Hamilton your Minder? And he said, oh, no. Lee's a fine man. You know, there's a lot of questions. Max Cleland basically left that 9/11 commission saying, he said it was a load of you know what. And he held up a copy of Forbidden Truth. He said, I think everybody on this commission should read this book. Well, what was in Forbidden Truth? It was all the negotiations about that Central Asian gas pipeline I spoke about and I write about in the book. That's what he was referring to, and he was firmly convinced that there was more to it than what we were being told. So, yeah, I think, now am I saying any government agencies were involved? No, but certainly people who are affiliated with those agencies were involved. There was just too many failures that day, and I think there was a lot of contractors working for these government agencies were involved. Realize one of the things that's happened, a lot of our government responsibilities have been outsourced to these contractors, and once you lose control like that, this kind of thing can happen, where people can interfere with NORAD and the FAA and the other functions that we expect to be carried out by government employees. In fact, they're not. They're being carried out by contractors. Yeah. I think Cheney, of course, knew more. We know. All we have to do is look at some of the quotes. We look at what transportation secretary said. He said that he heard Cheney asked by this military guy, "Do your orders still stand about the plane coming in from flight 77? I guess it was." Was heading towards the Pentagon. It seems like Cheney knew an awful lot about what was going on with that. And Cheney, If we go back and look at Cheney's background, he was in the Nixon administration. He was there during Watergate. This guy knew an awful lot about what was going on and all these scandals. Remember, he was also a congressman from Wyoming, and he was a member of the House Intelligence Committee during Iran-Contra. Guess who he gave a pass to? Cheney's one of the key guys in this whole thing. People say, what about George W. Bush? They would never tell him anything. Because he might screw up and actually say something. We could have exposed the whole operation. Yes?
About a month ago or 2 months ago, the White House posted something on their webpage saying and comparing conspiracy theorists to those that question 9/11 with terrorists or enemy combatants. Recently, Mr. Fetzer was on Bill O'Reilly's program, and Bill O'Reilly suggested there be an investigation of people that question 9/11 and so-called conspiracy theories. My question to you is, with the passage of H.R. 6166, do you believe that this was passed to continue to push Americans into a further state of fear, or do you think there actually is some sort of strategic, logistic purpose to that and the buildup of the concentration camps or the Kellogg Blue Ground detention centers?
Well, this administration, the only thing they have going for themselves is the fear factor. And, these bloviators like Bill O'Reilly, when they say this kind of, we need to investigate people, conspiracy people, terrorists. I mean, I think we ought to investigate Fox News and News Corporation, find out why they've been allowed to get this kind of power, have SEC investigations of them. I like to I still think the jury's out on Mr. O'Reilly and his producer and the phone sex. I'd like to investigate that further. I like to find out if he paid his producer off. She certainly bought a very expensive condominium on the Upper East Side of Manhattan at one point in time, and then the story seemed to have ended. What did O'Reilly pay, if anything? This is the thing. Why is it that the Democrats and the progressives are always on the playing defense with these people like O'Reilly and Limbaugh? They attack a guy like Michael J. Fox with Parkinson's disease. Keeping it legal, because Karl Rove does nothing really legal. He goes beyond the pale. But there's a lot of things we can do, and go on by going on the offensive. It's called opposition research. I'm somewhat heartened by some of it. I see some of it. The thing on going after this guy running for governor of Nevada, Gibbons, and this woman that came forward. That's good. We should be doing more of that. Because I'm telling you, for every Gibbons in Nevada or every Mark Foley, I can tell you there's 20 more that have not been discovered. And the information's out there. It doesn't take a lot of money to hire people to go and dig up this stuff on these hypocrites. They're hypocrites. I mean, you got Charlie Crist in Florida, run for governor, saying he's opposed to gay marriage, gay, civil unions, he's opposed to gay adoptions, and he's gay. And it's well known in Florida that he is. And so this information should be brought out on these people just to, shine sunshine, the disinfectant of sunshine on these people. Now on the House resolution, I think it's more fear that they're talking about. Yeah, the concentration, the detention centers, they say it's for illegal aliens. I'll tell you, I first heard about one of these centers down in Kern County, California, years ago. It's 70,000 capacity, right outside of Bakersfield, and it's under contract. The caretaker is Wackenhut Corporation. But this is nothing new. But where has the media been on it? I wrote about the Kern County facility. There's others being established around the country, and I fault the media on this.
I think there's a range of probability that applies to some planes flying across false flag, well, wearing Iranian colors, will attack the Enterprise at approximately 10 p.m. Gulf time on November the 6th. What do you think?
Well, yes. I mean, this the issue about the strike I think there's three or four strike groups over in the Iranian waters right now, and people expect, now they call it a November surprise because they ran out of days in October. It can't be an October surprise, but I'm glad the information's out there, and I'm glad, like, Cy Hirsch, I mean, there's not many of us that, you know, are willing to go out there and talk about this when we hear this, but these, obviously, this information's coming from people in the Pentagon who are been tasked to do contingency plans for this very thing. Now, whether they go ahead and arrange for a Gulf of Tonkin situation where, you know, you have a, they stage a phony attack, the fact that it's out there, the information's out there, people are a little, some people are wise to it. I'm more concerned not about November the 6th. I'm more concerned about what happens if the Democrats do take back the House. And maybe they even get a one-seat majority in the Senate, or it's a 50-50. And I'm more concerned about afterwards, and then we have an incident, and then all of a sudden the right-wing media starts blaming the new Congress. You see, we've got a new Democrat. They've already taken advantage of the situation. We now have a Democratic Congress. You see what happened? Because I think it's going to be kind of clear to a lot of people if it happens right before. I mean, not that some people won't be influenced by that, but I think a lot of people say, oh, come on, you got to be kidding. Yeah.
How do you, can you correlate or bring together your comments about the drug stuff as it pertains to drugs in the inner cities in terms of government involvement?
Oh, government involvement. Well, it's fairly certain that the Bush family has profited from the drug trade for an awful long time. And not just them, but we look at the whole gamut of the involvement of the CIA in this business going back to the 60s. You know, why was Porter Goss in Mexico? Why was he in southern Florida? And how did he go from that, being a covert guy in Latin America, to becoming the mayor of Sanibel Island? Now, everybody that lives in Sanibel Island knows that one of the most interesting catches you find off the coast of West Florida is what they call square grouper. That's nicely packaged bales of marijuana that are dumped off the coast and somehow are managed. They hit the tide right and the currents and it comes in. But the whole issue, I mean, I guess one of the most bizarre things I can recall was when John Deutsch was at that meeting in South Central L.A., defending the CIA against the charges that they were involved in pumping the drugs into South Central, and Maxine Waters, who I know, she was there. She was quite upset, and rightfully so. What I can tell you about this is something that never really saw the light of day. Another mysterious suicide, as I write about, is what happened to Mr. John Millis. Now, Bush was not president when this happened. This was June of 2000. It was during a campaign. So it was a big issue. It could have become a big campaign issue. But John Millis was the executive director for the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. He is said to have shot himself with a shotgun in a seedy motel room in Fairfax, Virginia, the Breezeway Motel, known by the locals as the Sleazeway Motel. I'll give you some idea what kind of place the executive director of the House Intelligence Committee was staying in when he shot himself. John Millis, according to people I spoke to in Congress, was part of this whole issue with the South Central thing. And, you know, what Gary Webb had written about earlier, there were three investigations conducted on this. One was a CIA IG investigation. The other one was a Justice Department investigation. And the other one was an investigation conducted by the House Intelligence Committee. The first two investigations were basically whitewashes. The CIA said, no, we weren't involved in anything, and that's why Deutsch went out there to basically say, yeah, we looked at this and there's nothing there, you know, with some caveats, but basically blew it off. Justice Department obviously gave themselves, said there's nothing to this either. However, what I understand, John Millis, who worked as a CIA agent in Afghanistan during the Mujahideen War, spent 2 years at NSA on an exchange program as an executive at NSA, 13 years with the intelligence community, thought otherwise. And what happened, all of a sudden, John Millis, who really runs the committee, if you know about committee structures in Washington, the congressmen and congresswomen are not running the show. It's the staff. And we can see that with the Foley matter. It's the staff that's under the gun for that. What did they cover up for the members? But just like with all committees, the Intelligence Committee is run by the executive director. He's the one that sees to the daily operations, makes sure the clearances and all the liaison with the agencies are conducted and the hearings and everything else. Millis, all of a sudden, when he said he thought this needs to be investigated, he wasn't going to do a whitewash. He got into a big argument with Porter Goss, the chairman, and it got really serious to the point where Porter Goss pulled his clearance, Millis's clearance, which is, this is amazing at this level. Millis was a Republican. I mean, if he wasn't a Republican, he wouldn't have been Porter Goss's executive director. That's how it works in Washington. If you're in the party, you get the nice job. When this happened to John Millis, he, of course, being a professional, he knew he had an issue with Porter Goss, so he went to the ranking Democrat, who was Julian Dixon, and said, "Hey, look, I'm having trouble. We have something in this report. We have a draft, and it is going to implicate the CIA. And I'm catching heat from Goss." And Julian Dixon said, "Well, what are you going to do?" And Millis seemed to indicate he was going to leak it. And then Dixon said, "Well, if you leak it, I owe the White House." It was Clinton at the time. I have to, as a courtesy, inform the White House if you're going to leak it, so they're not caught unprepared. It's not, I don't want you to leak it, because Dixon knew it was Goss that was covering the thing up. And obviously Goss was covering up. The other thing I wanted to mention about Millis, there's a thing called the Smithsonian Public Seminars. Millis, a couple of months earlier, had spoken at one of these Smithsonian things open to the public, where he actually stated that John Deutsch was the worst CIA director in the history of the CIA. Now, this is a public speech where the executive director is saying that about the then CIA director, who, of course, covered the thing up when he went to South Central. So we can see that there were these schisms between Millis and the intelligence bureaucracy, the corrupt intelligence bureaucracy. What Julian Dixon did was he informed the president's counsel at the time, Charles Ruff, that there was going to be a leak. But what happened? What happened was Millis had that draft with him. It's assumed he may have been meeting the person he was leaking it to at that motel where he supposedly shot himself. The draft was never uncovered. I went to the motel, and I was told by people that lived there that Van showed up, and then the detective in Fairfax City stated to the several residents, if somebody comes around and asks what happened to that man in that room, don't tell him anything. The body of Millis was taken into the county of Fairfax. See, the city of Fairfax sits within the county. It's independent on everything except mortuary services. That they use Fairfax County for that. And I spoke to the head of emergency services for the county, and I said, "Do you know that Millis's body was moved in, and we don't know what the autopsy results were?" He said, "I wasn't aware that this guy was moved into my county." So there was a lot of questions about this. Postscript to it, Millis is dead. They got something out of that room. Whoever these van people driving these vans, and in November, within 2 weeks of each other, the following November after the election in 2000, Julian Dixon dropped dead of a heart attack in Los Angeles, and Charles Ruff dropped dead of a heart attack in his home in Washington, D.C. within a couple weeks of one another. Maybe they were in bad health, but I spoke to people. Charles Ruff was an invalid. He had some disease that paralyzed him. He wasn't able to walk. You may remember him as one of Clinton's attorneys during the impeachment hearings. He was a man in a wheelchair. But I was told by people who knew them both that Neither one of them was in very bad health. Certainly there was no evidence that they were having heart problems.
Wayne Madsen, author of Jaded Tasks, Brass Plates, Black Ops, and Big Oil, The Blood Politics of George Bush and Company, speaking November 1st in Portland. Thanks to my friend Mel Ressler and to Glenn Owen for making that available. Madsen has a website, WayneMadsenReport.com, where you can read his articles. Unwelcome Guests has a website, UnwelcomeGuests.org, where you can download an archived copy of this and previous episodes of the show. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Like an old